российских активных мер,
активные мероприятия,
смотря на информационную войну Кремля, фальшивых новостей, кампанию дезинформации и пропаганды.
Hacking and leaking, front groups and cutouts, fellow travelers and useful idiots, counterfeiting and forgeries, intimidation and assassinations, troll farms and dramaturgy, fake news, slick disinformation and crude propaganda. Active measures have been part of the Kremlin's foreign policy toolkit for decades, if not centuries, and they've been at the forefront of our attention in recent years. How does the Vladimir Putin regime control all this chaos? How does the Kremlin manage its political war with the West? Today, we'll take a look. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of a brand new report for the European Council on Foreign Relations, Controlling Chaos, How Russia Manages Its Political War in Europe, which we'll be discussing today. Welcome, Mark, and congratulations on another great report.
Super. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks for the report. Joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU and co-author of the book Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries, which has just been reissued with a new chapter covering Russia's hacking campaign against the West, which we will also discuss today. Welcome back to the podcast, Andrei, and great chapter.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I guess we'll start with Mark's report because it kind of paints the broader picture, and we'll move into Andrei's new chapter of Red Web in the second half. Mark, a couple things jumped out at me in your report. The first was the juxtaposition of the chaotic and the ad hoc nature of many of Russia's active measure campaigns with the fact that these also appear to be part of a broader strategy that appears to be coordinated. The second thing that jumped out at me was your assertion that to the extent there is a coordinator, it's the presidential administration. Now, historically, we've always associated active measures with the security services, but they seem not to be organized. They seem to be organized and coordinated from Staraya Ploshad, not Lubyanka. Flesh these things out, if you would, and anything else you might want to add and highlight in the report.
Sure. Well, there's a wide open question. let me start with precisely the big picture. I think the more one looks at it, the more it is clear that this is not a single intricately planned, huge, seven-dimensional chess game that is being played. Rather, the role of the center is to do several things. I mean, clearly it has a broad, I don't even know if strategy is quite the right word, but intent, what it wants to see, which is essentially precisely to divide Europe from America, to bring institutions such as NATO and the European Union into a state of chaos, and to divide many countries within themselves so that essentially they are incapable of doing anything to resist Russia's own geopolitical agenda. So that's a very kind of a broad picture. And then in a way, you have everything from absolutely top-down state-run operations that do take place. And in part, this is what we'll be talking about in the second part with Andrei's excellent new chapter. But much of it is, in fact, in the hands of what I call political entrepreneurs, who could be anything from the local SVR, Foreign Intelligence Service, Residentura chief in some city, all the way through to an oligarch or a demigarch with a bright idea. And what they do is they start initiatives that they think will advance the Kremlin's agenda. And then the role of the center is to monitor what's happening, sometimes to provide guidance about what we regard as particular priorities at the moment. Sometimes it is to basically indicate backing away from some old line. But often what it is to look at this whole range of shall we say, private initiatives that are taking place, private geopolitical initiatives, and in some cases disassociate itself from ones that they think are not runners, and in other cases pick what it thinks of as the winners, and often not just simply bless them, but to throw additional resources. And this is where the coordination comes in. It's actually when something begins identified as an opportunity, that's when suddenly you see this, not just, for example, you know, more media agencies or similar, but you know, other maybe covert and similar things. So I mean, I think very much it is, again, to use that very sort of Russian usage, that the government is the curator of all this.
And if I could jump in, if something goes wrong, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions.
Absolutely,
as was the case with the failed coup attempt in Montenegro.
Precisely. I mean, all of these things. I mean, obviously, I mean, if we take the Montenegro one as an example, I mean, insofar as we know, and clearly this is all based on, you know, shadows, whispers, hints, and what little we do have from open source, but it seems to have primarily been the initial brainchild of Konstantin Malofeyev, the sort of, I can't recall him an oligarch, but a demigarch at least. Very strong nationalist credentials, prides himself on being the guy who brought Strelkov to Crimea, and clearly had had a distinctly mischievous role in the Donbass, is now particularly interested in the Balkans. He seems to have had this idea first, but clearly this was too big for him. It then seems to have gone to Patrushev, Secretary of the Security Council, who basically has been given the Balkans as his place.
So there was interest in this operation.
Well, and at some point it was decided, yes, this was a runner. Now, my understanding is that then that had to get sign-off from the very top, something like, you know, trying to sort of start a coup.
Yeah, that's,
but as soon as it gets that, it moves from beyond just simply being what one rich, well-connected guy can do. But that's when you start getting the GRU, military intelligence involved, and so forth. As soon as it were, the centre has decided to pick winners, it tends to lavish additional resources on them. And this is where they bring that second point in, where the presidential administration fits. Because I think this is the interesting thing, that the intelligence agencies are competitive. They're all trying to actually sort of win powers, resources, freedom, plaudits from the centre and so forth by proving that they're that much more useful. So in that respect, no one of them can actually control the others. I mean, in a way, that was part of the notion behind this idea of creating a Ministry of State Security, which Putin then, at least for the moment, backed away from. Yeah. So, you know, it's no way as, I mean, maybe in very specific operational situations, there are times when one agency is given primacy. Until the actual Donbass war started, the FSB clearly had primacy in Ukraine, for example. But there has to be some other organization which has personnel, which has key political influence, and which is actually outside the fray. And even the Security Council, you know, Patrushev is a player, not an arbiter. So I think the more I looked at it, the more it's interesting that the presidential administration, which has really become the central institution in so many ways in terms of running modern Russia. But when in the report, I go quite granular into deeply wonky details about, you know, which department seems to be involved in what and so forth. I have to.
There were some departments in there I'd never heard of, and I do this for a living.
I have to give plaudits to the ECFR's graphics people who took an incredibly complex diagram I created and make something sort of look faintly comprehensible from it. But I mean, I think it's clear that the presidential administration, it has that central role. It is Putin's management agency. It can speak with his voice. It is outside of the immediate political fray. And it also is large enough that it actually has the sheer staffing capacity to play some kind of role. It, you know, obviously it doesn't manage everything, but insofar as things are managed, they seem to be coordinated by that. I mean, in some ways, in this respect, the presidential administration is playing a role slightly akin to the British Cabinet Office, for example, as the sort of the ultimate coordinating arm of security, amongst other functions.
Andrei, you've done a lot of work on the Russian security services. What about this report jumped out at you, and how does it square with what you've learned in your own research and reporting on the Russian Siloviki?
Well, first of all, I should say that I love this report. I think it's Mark did a great job, and I think it's really good. And the idea that the presidential administration has this kind of role, that's been my understanding for many years, and I think there are some reasons for that. First of all, what we need to understand is that it looks that for the Kremlin, at least for some years, there is no line, strict line between, say, foreign operations and operations inside of the country. These people, they really believe that they are constantly under threat, under some sort of attack from the West, and the idea is you need to fight them, maybe in Moscow, maybe in Montenegro, maybe in Eastern Europe, but no matter, it's actually the same big fighting. We do not have any borders now. And it's very different from what we saw, say, in the Soviet Union, that it was impossible to use the same actors to do things inside of the country and outside of the country. Like we have APN, present day, Ria Novosti, Russia Today, doing things exclusively abroad of and beyond the borders of Russia, of the Soviet Union, not inside of the country. And now all these lines are blurred. And I think that might be the reason why the presidential administration has this role, because these guys were in charge of, say, finding a way how to control things inside of the country and fighting against hostile operations of some, I don't know, hostile forces inspired by CIA or maybe the State Department. And it's actually a very understanding of the world. The other reason is that actually because many of these things started many years ago, it was quite clear that, say, bureaucratic organizations like security services sometimes were surprisingly slow at providing a solution to the Kremlin. And in many cases, when you have this kind of slow response from these guys, you try to turn to some other guys who have an ability and they have an option to open the door close to the Kremlin. And quite physically, it's the administration of the president. So that's why it looks like many of the operations were maybe encouraged from the administration of the president or supported by the administration of the president. And sometimes carried out by the people on payroll of the administration of the president.
Another thing that comes to mind, and actually Andrei kind of jarred my brain into thinking about this, and I think he's correct to point out the blurring of domestic and foreign political operations. The Kremlin administration, of course, has long been the center of all political operations in the country. I mean, Vladislav Surkov as the first deputy chief of staff during Putin's first two terms in the Kremlin. After him, Vyacheslav Volodin, now the Speaker of the Duma. After him, Sergei Kiryenko has been responsible for the politics portfolio there. Mark, is there a Surkov? You know, we tend to think of Surkov as the master of the universe in the domestic realm in his time, and after him Volodin, and now it's supposed to be Kiryenko. We'll see how that works out. But is there a figure like this in there, or is this more diffuse in the foreign environment?
I think it's more diffuse. I mean, we have figures like Gromov, who is head of the foreign department within the presidential administration, who clearly plays a role. The interesting thing is the extent to which, as a corollary of this sense that the internal and the external battle lines are all part of the same campaign, is precisely the extent to which this is much, much more generic. I mean, it is clear that while he was still presidential chief of staff, that Ivanov, as an experienced foreign intelligence officer, was a key figure. But the presidential administration is not an operational center. It doesn't handle the fine details or whatever. It's about the broad political policy.
And picking the winners,
that is to a large extent a part of it. I mean, the same way as, you know, Peskov, Putin's personal sort of press spokesman, who is also obviously a key figure within the presidential administration. I mean, he has a weekly meeting with the editors of the main news outlets. And obviously, he's there to actually give the general sense of what do we think is important? What is the line going to be? What do we want to see in the media next week? But he doesn't sit down and dictate the stories.
Right.
He basically gives them a sense of what will please the Kremlin. And they then know that their job is, after all, to please the Kremlin. And they find different ways of doing that, which is why you do see, shall I say, a kind of a plurality within the yes-mannery. that they're all coming up with their own ways to be lickspittle, sort of servitors of the state. Well, likewise, I mean, I think so much of it sort of works in that way. Because, I mean, if we're talking about blurring of boundaries, I mean, as well as the internal and the external, I mean, we have to acknowledge the extent to which under Putin and this kind of sort of mobilization regime that he's created, the boundaries between the public and the private, state and non-state, have also become totally blurred. So again, I mean, I think you need some institution which can talk today to academics and think tankers, tomorrow to business people, and, you know, next week to soldiers and spooks from a similar position of authority, because otherwise, you know, it's very hard to get these different agencies and institutions and agents to be coordinated. And one of the key things is precisely when we do see these, you know, clear campaigns is exactly the extent to which they do coordinate across different platforms.
Mm-hmm. Now, you both follow the security services very closely, and something else that comes to mind is, yeah, they're all always at each other's throat. Do they bristle at being told what to do by a bunch of bureaucrats since Tsarevich? I mean, reporting to Putin is one thing, but reporting to...
I mean, I think there is an etiquette. I mean, Andrei will be able to talk certainly, especially about the FSB, who knows much more than I on that. As I understand it, I mean, precisely because of the sensitivities and the fact that these are powerful beasts in the political jungle, if there are instructions to be done, it doesn't come from a division head. It comes from one of the senior figures within the presidential administration. Uh-huh. And even then, it's handled in a relatively, you know, it's over drinks as a chat rather than getting someone in and barking orders at them.
And it's clear this person is speaking for the president.
Well, then. Precisely. I mean, and obviously, I mean, and if they have a particular problem, then they also have their own channels to actually petition the president. You know, we shouldn't assume that this is an absolute sort of done deal necessarily.
Yeah,
but clearly,
Bortnikov has a channel to.
I think it's fair enough. But on the other hand, when people sort of slightly further down the presidential administration want to basically, shall we say, handle the security services, as I understand it, they do so with considerable decorum and care. But you know, but if it's something that really needs to be pushed,
it's kicked
then
upstairs,
it goes right. up to the top. Yeah.
Andrei, does that square with what you see?
Yeah, I think it's quite correct. And the problem is that because we are dealing with people who've been appointed to the position so many years ago, so in the Russian way, their own bureaucracy, there are so many informal channels. Like you do not talk only to, not speak only to the head of the FSB. Lots of generals, lots of his deputies, they have some connection, informal channels to the administration of the president. And indeed, we got some new guys at the level of deputy director of the FSB quite recently, over the last 2 years. And these people, they were actually appointed with the understanding with if they need to, we can contact directly with the administration of the president. So it's a very informal kind of communication. It's not that was, I mean, I think that's, it's actually, it's not, it was not deliberately designed, but because the Kremlin has been doing these things under pressure. I mean, they always feel that they are under pressure. Something coming on them, and they need to understand what to do very quickly. And the Russian policy is not very surprisingly, it's so reactive. They react to things, and they need to react very quickly, mm-hmm. which means that they need to do things sometimes bypassing formal channels of communications because these channels tend to be extremely slow. Mm. That's why we got this kind of mixed of informal / formal communication lines.
Now, the elephant in the room here for me, too, is the agency that's supposed to be responsible for Russian foreign affairs, that being the foreign ministry. Where do they are they just on the sidelines here?
Oh, bless. Well, yeah, I mean, I think they very much, I mean, look, on the one hand, look, it is still clearly a powerful institution. It is a big institution. It has a sort of massive array of, I was going to say embassies and consulates, a few fewer consulates.
Few fewer.
But anyway, you know, it is there. But I think the key thing is
are they in the loop?
Well, look, are they in the loop? I don't actually believe that the foreign minister now has that much traction. I think Lavrov has now shrunk to a relative sort of small effigy of his once sort of colossal status, and certainly on key decisions, it looks as if his job is to execute, not to discuss.
And to explain.
But I think the thing is, I mean, in some ways, we shouldn't be surprised because, again, you might say, this is not about foreign affairs. If it was just about foreign affairs, one would expect the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to be responsible. This is precisely about a conflict, a struggle. And in that respect, the MFA is one more of the various sort of constituent elements, some of which are stronger and some of which are weaker. You know, the FSB and the military are clearly more powerful elements. the MFA, you might say, is in the same band, but obviously it's just rather further down the spectrum. But the notion that the MFA should be running, that I think is, again, it's a very inaccurate sense, because it's based on kind of very Western notions of foreign affairs compared with, shall we say, military and intelligence operations. The Russians see this really as all part of one, almost one could say, hybrid realm of external operations.
And when you're looking at this presidential administration, I've been trying to think. You brought the Office of Government Affairs into for kind of a British analogy. I'm trying to come up with a Soviet analogy of something that has become as powerful as the presidential administration in foreign and domestic affairs. I mean,
Central Committee.
I mean, is this basically are we talking about the Central Committee?
Central Committee without a Communist Party.
The Central Committee without a Communist Party.
I mean, ironically enough, the Communist Party reflected a powerful check and balance within the system. You've now got all the institutions of centralization that was embodied in the Central Committee apparatus without the checks and balances.
Mm. Andrei, would you concur with that?
I totally agree. Actually, they live in the same offices. They
I was going to point that out. Another thing I wanted to talk about here is that the current level of intensity we've been seeing with Russian active measures over the past several years is relatively new. This has evolved over time. How has it evolved, Mark? Did you see kind of an evolution in your research for this report?
I mean, I think it's more a case of potentials that had sort of slowly built up suddenly becoming mobilized and activated. I mean, in a way, look, we have seen this in many ways, the presidential administration bit by bit replace the other government structures. And in some ways, I mean, I think that really happened 2011-2012 with Putin's return to the presidency. Because what we'd had is the slow creeping deinstitutionalization of the system under the first two Putin terms, but only partial. But then when he was going to become prime minister, well, you know, prime minister plus, and Medvedev was going to become president minus, that was a point as in where they actually stopped and looked, I think, at the actual mechanics of governance. Because in a way, he had to work out which people and which institutions he was going to have to shift across. So instead of, as it were, pointing at the Kremlin, it would be pointing at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what got it. And obviously, therefore, you had this sort of strange situation during the Medvedev presidency of almost, shall we say, a bipartite government,
right,
or a sort of shadow presidential administration in the White House. But then when Putin returns, everything gets mulched together. And then that happens, and I don't think it's entirely coincidental, to also coincide with a dramatic sharpening of these geopolitical tensions. So I think at this very same time that the presidential administration is becoming much more formally at the center of the political system is also the time when so much of governance is about managing this political war. So the two basically dovetail.
Did they just dovetail, or was that intentional? I mean, that's...
I think it's not actually they thought, well, we're going to be fighting a political war, so let's build up a presidential administration. It's actually that increasingly these are the guys, you know, from Putin's point of view, these are the guys he turns to anyway to get anything done. And again, I mean, I think Andrei was absolutely on the nail when he said one of the key things is not only do they have physical proximity, they're just down the corridor,
right. But
they, you know, they are able to and have an imperative to do things quickly.
Uh-huh.
So you might say because the political war is at the center of policy, then clearly that becomes a presidential administration sort of importance. If actually we were in a totally different timeline and there was some kind of massive economic modernization project, then probably the presidential administration would be full of economists.
Right.
exactly. It's basically, its role is to be whatever Putin wants it to be.
Right. Okay. Andrei, how do you see the evolution of these active measures campaigns changing over time? Because they're leading up to this intensity.
Well, first of all, it's not anymore active measures. So the new euphemism is assistance programs or assistance operations. Actually, I was told this story by some former SVR officer who was chief of station in New York, that back in the beginning of 1990s, CIA came to the FSB and said, look, you need to stop active measures because we are not anymore enemies. And the SVR just renamed the department, and now it's not active measures department, but not a department, but assistance operations department. So actually it's the same thing, but well, the new name. I think that actually this evolution started maybe a bit earlier. I think for me, the most crucial year was maybe the year of Putin's Munich speech and an attack on Estonia, because that was a moment when we see two things. First, that Putin started building new institutions, I mean, meaning propaganda abroad, all these things about Russia today. And it also was a moment that we saw how the administration of the president started using tools built primarily to attack opposition inside of the country. I mean, pro-government, pro-Kremlin youth movements, attacking targets abroad, in Estonia, as we all know. Mm-hmm. An attack on Estonia was carried out by actually under guidance of Nazi. So that was a moment when we saw this kind of things converging. And well, of course, 2014 was also extremely important, because that was a moment when we see not only people but also techniques I used very first time, maybe not inside of the country but out of the country in the Ukraine. So maybe these two dates are really crucial to me.
I mean, I agree with you. 2007, there was a lot going on there. You mentioned the establishment of RT. You had the hacking attack on Estonia in the midst of the Bronze Horseman controversy. You had Putin's Munich speech. And just a year earlier, you had probably the biggest active measures operation to that date of all, the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko in London. Right. So, but I'm always looking for the breaking point, it's 2003-04. Because this is essentially the colored revolution years, when I think that was those were the years that the Kremlin decided that it was at war with the West. Mark, anything to add there?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you sort of talk about Estonia and so forth. I think one other aspect that I found sort of interesting for me when I was preparing this report was I was trying to look at why they, although they have a single broad strategic sort of set of goals, nonetheless, they operate differently in different European countries. And I think this is one of the interesting things, that trying to actually create some kind of schema and almost work out what the variables were, not that I claim to be a political scientist. And I think it is clear that it's the essentially conjunction of how vulnerable a country is to Russia, whether it's in terms of it has cultural ties, economic dependency, and so forth, and the strength of its institutions. And if you take something like
affinity Estonia, and vulnerability, two matrices.
And the sort of the vulnerability is kind of primarily in institutional terms or whatever. Now, I mean, in that sense, you know, someone like Estonia, I mean, I think it's really interesting, because I was trying to think, well, what is it they really want from Estonia? You know, were they ever honestly thinking Estonians were going to, become Russian vassals, or actually decide that they loved the Russians deeply after all? Of course not. But it's clear that a country like Estonia, which in some ways has been written off already, I mean, I think of all the European countries, I think the Estonians are the ones that, certainly Putin, but I think generally speaking Russia, have basically decided that they're just kind of pathological Russophobes, and I imagine many Estonians would glory in that. So actually they use Estonia actually as an example. On the principle, they have nothing to lose with Estonia. So basically, they can show off what they can do.
So this is a country with low vulnerability, with strong institutions, low affinity,
yeah,
not very much pro-Russian sentiment there. And so, yeah, they make an example.
So they make an example, or they try and demonize it, try and say, "Oh, this is why the West is all full of people who just intrinsically hate Russia or whatever." And then one can look at other European countries in other situations, and it's clear. In some cases, they seek elite capture. In some cases, they are just simply trying to assert influence on very, very specific areas. It varies. So I think what we can also say is that there is a degree of nuance. There is a very, very broad objective. But on the other hand, when one looks at individual countries, there is nuance. And I mean, we're going to be talking about the hack of the United States. I think actually the United States fits into that sort of model as well, as a country without any sort of great affinity for Russia, but nor, on the other hand, a sort of a huge... Well, but actually institutional vulnerabilities, because precisely they're working at a time when there were sort of certain sort of tensions within the body politic that they can exploit. So, I mean, I think, again, because there is this degree of sort of case-by-case nuance of the strategy, again, part of the presidential administration's role is to sort of mediate that so that people are aware that, you know, no one actually expects that any of the Baltic states can really be sort of taken over by Russian allies in a way that perhaps certain other more southern and eastern European countries, they could have more ambitions. So people know what they really ought to be sort of aiming for.
Mm-hmm. Andrei, anything to add to that?
I would add one thing, that we need to remember how sometimes emotional these people could be. And I think that's actually might be the answer why sometimes we see operations carried out in countries with no hope for any kind of success. And it looks to me that sometimes, for example, in France recently, why on earth they decided to leak this material a day before the elections? There was no sense in it. Except one thing, but it's the idea of showing off. But we can do that. And you should count on it, and you should remember about Russia, how Russia is important. And I think that with Estonia, might be the very first impulse was to respond, because it's always about reactions for them. But also the idea, well, we need to remind you that Russia is the count you need to remember about, and you need to count, and you need just to think about the position of Russia.
Now, before we move into the second half, and we will discuss your new chapter, Andrei, I wanted to hit on another note here, and that's that for years Russia's been able to do this stealthily, right? People weren't really paying that much attention to it. Now it's seeped into the broader consciousness. This has led to, as Andrei, you pointed out, one screw up in the French election. And I would think they screwed up larger than that in the French. I think they misread that election just horribly, both strategically and tactically. But then thinking that, you know, creating a sex scandal around a presidential candidate's going to hurt that candidate in France is just shows a remarkable lack of understanding of that country. They messed up in Germany with the Lisa case and with other things. So now that everybody's talking about it, now that everybody's wise to it, has this changed the Kremlin's approach?
Well, again, I think one has to realize that three things, really. One is, actually, the Kremlin has relatively little scope to change its approach if it wants to continue this struggle. It's not like it actually has much of a plan B or plan C. Secondly, a lot of this is not about generating specific effects. I mean, you know, take Andrei's point about France, or indeed Estonia. It was not actually that they thought, well, we are going to get this outcome out of it. It was more, it was just a case of, we want to just show what we can do and realize, and make people realize that Russia is a big player, whether they like it or not. I mean, again, I think this is it. I think that Putin has embraced this notion that he's not going to make friends, so he just simply needs to be enough of a problem that there are people who feel he needs to be dealt with, he needs to be sort of brought into the system. Exactly, geopolitical extortion. So, I mean, I think in that respect, you know, one could say that the very fact that we're all talking about it is actually a sort of a positive outcome in a way.
We're being Putin's little helpers here.
Absolutely, aren't we all? But the final point I would make is that, I mean, a lot of the desired impact is negative. A lot of the desired impact is not to bring anything about, but to shatter and fragment the bonds of trust within political systems, between countries, and so forth. And in that respect, even when we're talking about it, I mean, we have this often very disgraceful and disreputable sort of shouting matches as people are being precisely denounced as precisely Putin's sort of unwilling, you know, his useful idiots and unwitting stooges, and others say, oh no, you're just acting as a sort of a xenophobic NATO shill or whatever. You know, actually, it has created almost a self-sustaining division. So I think if your aim is, again, I mean, the title of this report is Controlling Chaos. If you're aiming to create chaos in the hope of nudging it in the right direction, chaos is still sadly being created, even if actually it's the control that is the problem from Putin's point of view.
Andrei, any last words before we go to the second half?
Well, to be honest, when I try to find some logic in these things, I always remember this big spy scandal of 2010 in the United States when Russian illegals were caught, and how the same story, this story, was played in two countries as a big success. That was a really surprising thing. Like, it was obviously a big success for FBI and CIA and because we caught the Russian spies, but it was also shown to the Russian public as a big success because we are back. So sometimes this idea of being back, of being a superpower again, is the main driving force.
So there's no reason to change tactics, even though we're onto it. All the more Tiambola, just keep doing it because it seems to be working.
I think in so many ways, I mean, I've mentioned this before, I think sort of Putin has exhausted many of his opportunities to evolve further. I think reinvention. Yeah, there'll be tactical tweaks, but I don't see any major change.
All right. Well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and narrow the aperture to look at a very specific type of active measure, Russia's hacking campaign against the United States and the West. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me in here in the studio is co-host Mark Eliade, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the new report for the European Council on Foreign Relations, Controlling Chaos, How Russia Manages Its Political War in Europe. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU and co-author of the book Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries, which has just been reissued with a new chapter covering Russia's hacking campaign against the West, which we will soon discuss. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Российские хакеры самые богатые.
Страшные российские хакеры добрались даже до
главные герои русские хакеры, которые
They've hacked the opposition, they've hacked the Estonians, Georgians and the Ukrainians, they've hacked the Europeans, they hacked the French television station, a German steelmaker, the Polish stock market, and the Bundestag, as well as the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. State Department. But when they hacked the U.S. election, suddenly everybody started paying attention. Andrei, you and your co-author, Irina Boragan, have just published a new edition of your book, Red Web, that pulls back the veil on the Kremlin's decision to hack the servers of the Democratic National Committee and release the contents via WikiLeaks, effectively hacking a U.S. presidential election. I read your chapter yesterday in preparing for this program, and a few things jumped out at me. First, the sense in the Kremlin that the Panama Papers, which were published last April, were a U.S. effort to attack Putin. I know they were saying this when the Panama Papers came out, and I just took it as rhetoric and propaganda for domestic political purposes. You seem to have uncovered that they actually believe this, and that the hacking of the U.S. election was somehow revenge for this. The second thing that jumped out at me, you note this crucial meeting of the Russian Security Council on April 8th, 2016. Actually, it was a meeting of eight members of the Security Council. All the members were not present when the decision was apparently made. And that 2 weeks after this meeting, the domain DC Leaks, which was one of the main conduits for the leaked emails, was registered. And finally, you shed some light on something that I was very intrigued with when it happened, that very strange case back in January in which two FSB officers working in counterespionage, Sergei Mikhailov and Dmitry Dokuchaev, as well as Ruslan Stoyanov, a former Interior Ministry official who worked for the cybersecurity company Kaspersky Lab, were arrested and charged with espionage. I wrote about that when it came out. It seems I got it wrong, judging from this was part of a larger cleanup effort to kind of after the election is what you seem to be saying. Flesh these things out for us, Andrei, as well as anything else you think is relevant here.
Well, I think the first thing that we need to remember about this hacking operation, it was a very long operation. It started back in the summer of 2015, and it looks like there were many phases of the operation. So the first phase was, we can call it conventional espionage. Some hackers, they penetrated the system and started collecting stuff very quietly. And it looks like in the beginning, say until May, March, and April, there was no intention to weaponize this information, to leak it to some websites. And it was a conventional espionage. But when we got this new development, we got Panama Papers. And yes, it was a very personal thing for Putin. He decided himself to respond to this attack. He personally commented on this investigation and attacking journalists and attacking the whole thing. And it was very unusual and very surprising, because we all know as Russian journalists that the best way for the Russian government to respond to the story is never comment on it, on the story, just to let it die. In this case, Putin decided to comment and to attack and to say something. And that was the very first glimpse when we saw that WikiLeaks is part of the problem, because WikiLeaks as well decided to attack journalists working on Panama Papers. And then Putin himself picked up WikiLeaks squad and used it to the effect that now, thanks to WikiLeaks, we know who were behind this operation. And then some sources told us and hinted that there was a meeting, a crucial meeting in the Kremlin with some top-level officials. Then this problem was discussed.
This is the April 8th meeting, yeah?
Exactly. And we think that this meeting on April 8th looks like it could be this meeting when this problem was discussed, how to respond. And it looks like that was a moment when the decision was taken that now the information which was gathered before need to be used publicly, need to be weaponized.
Uh-huh. So this was initially, this hacking was just an intelligence gathering operation, as you said, just typical espionage. This is right. Kind of happenstance that, okay, we have to have some kind of revenge for the Panama Papers. So, and all right, let's give them a taste of their own medicine. That was the thing. I mean, it still is remarkable to me that they actually believed that the Panama Papers were actually some kind of U.S. operation, because let's face it, then it was also a U.S. operation against the United Kingdom, Iceland, Argentina, and many other Ukraine and many other countries as well. I mean, this brought the Icelandic government down. But you're convinced they really, really, really believe this.
Yeah, because there was one thing which we need to remember. There was a strange remark made by Putin about Panama Papers. He said that the paper, the newspaper which published it first, the expose of his personal friend, Roald Dugin, was actually owned by Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, that was weird.
That was really weird, because nobody understood that. The problem was that it looks like by that moment, Vladimir Putin had been already briefed about what was found in Podesta emails. And we all know that the biggest thing found in these emails was a thing about free paid speeches given by Hillary Clinton at Goldman Sachs. So he immediately made this connection and decided that the whole thing was orchestrated by Hillary Clinton. So it was personal in many directions. It was personal against him, and it was personal because it was orchestrated by Hillary Clinton, who was running for the president of the United States.
And also, it's worth mentioning, after all, this is also a Kremlin that genuinely believes that the CIA was behind Euromaidan, etc., etc. Mm. I mean, what may seem like paranoid lunacy to us is, I'm sure, sitting in a Manila folder.
Well, it's also, I mean, I had to read that section of the chapter a couple times to make sure I got it. I mean, because it's the connecting Goldman Sachs to the Panama Papers, must have just been in Putin's mind, Goldman Sachs, and somehow he conflated it, because there's no other connection at all. Yes, he was getting this information at the same time, so he just conflated it. Right.
I think it was a big. Well, actually, it tells us something about the level of intelligence analysis. I mean, these guys might be pretty good at collecting stuff, but when something could happen and they can present it in this manner, and actually we got this confusion.
Yeah, and even after the fact, I mean, Peskov uncharacteristically walked back the president's comment and said, "Well, we just got a bad briefing note there at the time." So, and maybe that would have been one of those rare instances where Peskov was actually telling the truth. The other thing, Andre, that really, as I said, the arrest of Mikhailov, Dokuchaev, and Stoyanov, this you really shed a lot of new light on this case for me. So could you flesh that out a bit?
Well, the thing is that It looked like for the people in the Kremlin, the whole thing became suddenly much bigger than they, say, anticipated. They anticipated that there would be some leaks and some outrage in the media, but they got, well, first of all, they got Trump supporting and sometimes using WikiLeaks in his speeches, and we have the whole, well, everybody talking about Russian involvement, so everybody understood in Moscow, especially when actually in November after the election, that look, it's getting bigger. We need to do something very, very quickly to cover up the whole thing. And that was a moment when it looks like a decision was taken to try to say prevent any kind of leaks about what actually had happened, and the idea was to take care of say we have some gatekeepers, if you wish, some people who were go-betweens between say Russian cyber community and the West, because for many years there has been a cooperation between the Western security services and law enforcement agencies and the Russian security services. There were some joint investigations, and of course people know each other. And the thing is that the Kremlin always tries to limit the number of the people who actually were sanctioned to talk to the West. And actually it was about few guys in the FSB and few guys at the Security Council. And it was quite surprising and might be remarkable that almost simultaneously, a guy who was in charge of top-level talks with the Americans at the level of Security Council was quietly dismissed and replaced with another FSB general who has nothing to do with cyber and just know nothing about cyber. So he's absolutely safe in terms of possible leaks. And at the same time, people at the level of operations, at the level of the Information Security Department of the FSB, were just sent to jail. And the guy who was also in charge of say, maintaining these ties with the Western cybersecurity community, Ruslan Stoyanov, who was very well connected. That was his job, actually, to connect everybody. He was in charge of connecting the FSB with corporations who were victims of cyber attacks. And he was also in charge of connecting Russian security guys with Western security guys. And he was very proud of being in charge of some big joint international investigations of Russian hackers. And he was also sent to jail. And so the idea was just to shut them and to limit access to them. And obviously, well, in Russia, the best place to do this is the Lefortovo prison, the most... Yes, Lefortovo is the most secure facility in Russia, and it's extremely difficult to leak anything from this prison. Remarkably, Ruslan Stoyanov found a way to leak his letter out of Lefortovo, where he hinted that he became a victim of this struggle, of this new connection, not new actually, but newly exposed connection between the Russian secret services and the criminal world of hackers.
I mean, that's something that's been widely known, that the security services recruit hackers. But the other thing, too, is that my assumption when this case broke was that these guys were freelancing a bit, as security service officers will do, and they may have inadvertently leaked something, maybe to the Steele dossier or something like that. This was my working assumption at the time. I thought this was an illustration, because remember the Shalty Baltai case was brought into it all, and I thought this was just kind of illustrating the kind of ties between the security services and the criminal world, and that something inadvertently in this situation accidentally got leaked to the Americans, or to, in this case, a British investigator working for the Americans. But it seems like these guys didn't do anything. They just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Is that correct?
Exactly. And the problem is that we need to remember about the timeline. We need to remember that there was a very strange thing with the U.S. intelligence response to the hacking operation. For some months, they didn't know what to do. Maybe they were very silent because Obama administration didn't want to compromise the whole thing. I mean, to compromise Hillary Clinton attacking Trump and trying to do a real investigation. But the thing is, what we got first, we got U.S. intelligence report, and only after that, we got to the level of intelligence gathering stage of operation when some Russian hackers were approached and actually caught in Europe. And it looks like some of these guys were caught only because they could be a useful source of information about this connection between the FSB and the criminal hackers. Actually, only in December, we got the very first time in the history, we got two FSB officers on the FBI wanted list. It's absolutely unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So it looks like people in the Kremlin in on Lubyanka, they just thought, look, we see now the Americans getting more and more active in trying to understand what's going on and trying to catch some people. So now we need to do anything we can just to stop them and to prevent any kind of leaks.
Uh-huh. So, and then in these arrests, Mikhailov, Dokuchayev, and Stoyanov came in January, so that would fit.
No. It was reported in January, but they were actually arrested in December.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so it still fits the timeline then. Mark, right. Anything to add here?
Yeah, I mean, I should actually add again, I think it's an excellent chapter. I'm not sure if I should be excited or depressed. Unfortunately, that we're likely to see many more editions of this book with many new chapters
being added. Yeah, I think you've got work for a long time, Andrei.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I think what I'd like to do is actually, in a way, try and connect the two parts, because I think it's, what's really interesting, the way that this sort of emerges, this story of the hack, is precisely how it connects with what I've been saying about the sort of the management of active measures or assistance operations. is that precisely you have on the one hand it starts with a very kind of conspiratorial wartime mindset that's being adopted by the people at the top of the system, you know, Putin believing that the Panama Papers are directed towards him. And okay, I mean, a lot of the early Western media attention was precisely on Roldugin and so forth because that was a good sexy story, but as you say, in fact, the Panama Papers was massively broader than
brought
just
down the
Russian.
Icelandic government. David Cameron was hurt by this. I mean, didn't bring
not
him
enough.
Down yet.
but the point is exactly, but you know, as far as he's concerned, it's all about him. It's all about, you know, everything right. must come down to some kind of Western plot or whatever. So you have this exceedingly sort of conspiratorial perspective, and therefore people scrambling to address that. As Andrew says, I mean, you actually had just perfectly normal intelligence gathering by what seems to have been a GRU and a separate FSB
that had been going on for
operation.
Years.
Precisely, you know, I mean, which is what intelligence services do. They just hoover up information that might be useful at some point. And although it seems to be the GRU that actually gathered the stuff that was leaked, there seems to be no evidence that they're much less into this kind of political operation of the sort of non-kinetic kind, were behind this. Instead, you actually, as I understand it, had the FSB who were saying, GRU's come up with some stuff. We reckon you could do something with that. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, again, if we take this to that 8th of April 2016 Security Council meeting that wasn't really a Security Council meeting because so many of the permanent members
weren't there. There were eight people present, from what I understand.
There are eight people present. I mean, basically, they're all ex-KGB except for two, which was the Interior Minister Kolokoltsev and Valentina Matvienko, the sort of Senate chair and sort of hairdo with legs. And you know, they clearly were not the sort of key players there. I mean, the notional subject of that meeting was the National Guard, hence Kolokoltsev's position and what's going on in Nagorno-Karabakh. But the key thing is, I mean, you didn't have the Minister of Defense, you didn't have the head of military intelligence, you didn't have the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and you didn't even have the Prime Minister. You know, these are meant to be permanent members, but they were not there. So again, it says something about this ad hoc structures that come together to make broad policy decisions. And they did it on the basis of, you know, let's say, an entrepreneurial take from, in this case, the FSB, that says, we have this intelligence, we think something can be done with it. And then once the decision is made, then it just goes to the presidential administration just to kind of handle the nuts
right.
and bolts.
Now, if you think of who was there, it was Bortnikov, Patrushev, Fradkov, of course, Putin. You mentioned Kolokoltsev, Matvienko. And who else was there? It was
Narishkin.
But, you know, and exactly, I mean, these are all the kind of people. This is the kind of meeting you gather if you want a certain kind of result.
You know, and it had nothing to do with Nagorno-Karabakh or the National Guard.
Well, I'm sure that was probably somewhere on the agenda too. But generally speaking, the art of after all running a good meeting is to make sure that you invite the people who are going to say the things that you want the meeting to decide. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly the way this operates. I mean, I think what Andreas has pulled together has been a sort of a very compelling case of actually how even a massive and geopolitically crucial operation can come out of flawed intelligence, the misuse of intelligence, and a totally flawed perspective on how the world really works. Mm.
Andrei, anything to add? You know, as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking this is a case study. I mean, Andrei's chapter is a case, like you pointed out. I see a piece here somewhere. You two should get on the phone or something. Andrei, anything to add to Mark's assessment there?
No, I totally agree. I think that's really interesting that such important things might be decided out of sense of desperation when people are driven by some emotional ideas about how things are going against them, and they just need to respond very quickly. And finally, we got these results, and it's sad that finally we are talking all the time. We are talking about reactions. We are talking about responses. But these responses, they fit exactly the same. Well, they actually all this the same. They are of the same logic and of the same strategy. We have these measures. We have these options on the table. So why not to use them? We use these options against, say, Russian opposition and Russian journalists and Russian activists. Why not try these things abroad? Because we can.
Yeah, no, it's interesting the escalation, and I in my introductory remarks in this section, I intentionally tried. First they did it with the opposition, then they did it in the so-called near abroad, then they did it in Europe, and then they did it to America. There was this kind of escalation of where they were willing.
Can't help notice they haven't tried it with China.
No, they haven't tried it with China yet, and I don't think they will. The other thing I noted, Andrei, was that, I mean, you didn't say this outright, but they were, despite the popping of the champagne corks in the Duma after the election in the U.S., there were people in the Kremlin and the security services who were saying, my God, what have we done? And there was serious concern about this, which suggests to me that the goal here wasn't to achieve a specific result in the election. It was to go ahead.
Exactly. I think the idea was just to harm Hillary Clinton. Just remember, these guys, they have this conspiratorial mindset. They believe that everything about the U.S. election is already predetermined. It's that everybody already made sure that Hillary Clinton would be the next president. What could be done, well, some harm could be done, and maybe we can get the new president, but at least she would be very weak. And I remember also that it has been a question of national security for Russia because of the sanctions. So it was a kind of justified. And also it was justified by the idea that Hillary Clinton was behind the Moscow protests in 2011, 2012. So for Putin, who was very sensitive about these things, about so-called interference of foreign powers, the idea that now something could be done about a person who interfered in his elections and in his internal political situation looked like a completely understandable and justifiable thing.
Mm. So, God, if Hillary Clinton didn't exist, do you think that Putin would have to invent her? I mean, she was responsible for Bolotnaya. She was responsible for the Panama Papers. What can't she do?
Oh, and Euromaidan.
And Euromaidan, of course. That's right. That's right. Now, the other thing, Andrei, you shed a little bit of light on the Steele dossier in this chapter. Can you flesh that out a bit?
Well, the thing is that we were given some pieces of Steele dossier back in September, in the middle of September of the last year. And to be honest, our immediate reaction was that it can't be true because of some juicy details, because some names were completely wrong, and some mistakes were made. But finally, when we got the full report, it looks for us that maybe... especially the thing how the decision-making process was described. That rings completely true. because the way how things were described, I mean, the idea what kind of services could be involved, that was very, say, different from the picture painted by the US intelligence and cybersecurity companies in June and actually in the summer of 2016. Remember that the idea of the US intelligence report was that we have two security services, GRU and the FSB. We were in charge. We have the primary role for the military intelligence. That's all. That's it. The Steele dossier tried to paint a completely different picture. The idea was that we have some informal actors, we have the FSB, played a much bigger role, and we have the administration of the president, and the administration of the president was the final point. Actually, that was the final instance, the final institution to decide how to run this operation. And it also quite correctly described how confused people became in a way, when the situation evolved and they understood that it's getting bigger than they all anticipated.
Mm-hmm. Mark, anything to add before you wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm much less convinced by the Steele dossier, I must say. Yes, it does convey the essential confusion that was taking part in Moscow, absolutely. But, I mean, I think a lot of the details, you know, the role of Peskov, certainly the role of Ivanov, I don't actually buy. And
the role definitely of Ivanov, and that Ivanov was opposed to the operation?
Well, that he was behind it. But essentially that this was behind Ivanov's leaving his position at the presidential administration, the notion of these sort of Bulgarian hackers. I mean, look, Is there likely to be some grains of truth within it? Yes, absolutely. But this is, for me, the sort of the sweepings from the floor of any one sort of bibulous evening in a Moscow restaurant of choice, because no one really knows what's happening in the system. Everyone has a little bit of sort of rumour and gossip, and they kind of throw things together. But I think in some ways, the point, and in some ways, this is where definitely I would agree with Andrei. What comes across is precisely this very confused, personalised, and ad hoc structure of managing policy. And although I don't believe that Steele puts it together in anything like the right way, nonetheless, I think this is the problem that we're having to come to deal with. We are still used to institutions, formal policies, wire diagrams, all these ways of understanding complexity, which is how Western states are run. Just as the Russians are mirror imaging us, I was in Moscow just before the elections, and someone who's pretty senior within the sort of the foreign affairs world told me with absolute confidence that there is no way that the American establishment would allow Trump to win. Mm-hmm. Again, they were certain. You know,
well, this
they
is
mirror
fundamental
image.
Attribution bias.
You exactly. Mean, so they assume that actually we are more like them than we are. Well, likewise, we have to realize that actually they are less like us than we might assume, and that there is this extraordinary sort of amorphous structure of governance and policymaking that we're desperately trying to come to terms with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, on that note, we shall wrap it up. You've certainly given us a lot to chew on. I'd like to remind you, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the new report for the European Council on Foreign Relations, Controlling Chaos, How Russia Manages Its Political War in Europe. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow has been Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU, and co-author of the book Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries, which has just been reissued with a new chapter on Russian hacking campaign. You'd be sure to read it. I would highly recommend that. Thank you both for an interesting and enlightening discussion.
It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.